This is Max Q, the podcast by Peabody's Launchpad office dedicated to demystifying what life is like after graduation. Every episode, we sit down with a recent Peabody alum to get their take on what life is like for working artists in today's world. Multifaceted careers, time management, finances, finding balance between your life and your work. We explore that and more on the Max Q podcast.
Hi, everyone. I'm Christina Mancior. Today's interview is with Thomas Fortner, who is a conductor and cellist who graduated from Peabody in 2017. Currently, he is based in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, where he is assistant conductor and youth orchestra music director of the South Dakota Symphony Orchestra. He is also the founder and artistic director of the Iowa Great Lakes Music Festival and artistic and executive director of the Dakota Sky Foundation. Thomas, thanks so much for joining us today. Really appreciate your time. To get started, can you tell us a little bit about what does your life looks like right now?
Well, I live in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. I'm the assistant conductor and youth orchestra music director of the South Dakota Symphony. We're in the middle of the coronavirus pandemic, but we've started our season, and it's been very, very interesting time, put it that way.
Yeah, you could say that. has your life and schedule differed a lot within the pandemic versus before?
You know, typically for the youth, as a youth orchestra music director, I spend the summer with the staff planning out what the season's going to look like for the kids and what the repertoire is going to be and putting together the schedule for the concerts and the venues and all that stuff. And it usually takes, 3 months of, a couple hours a day work, maybe less than that. This summer, because of the pandemic, because we had really no idea what things were going to look like, and we still don't really know. We've already started our season. We've already started our in-person rehearsals after a month of being online. It's been a crazy amount of preparation and logistical work up front. That's far more than we've ever done before. So as far as how it's affected my schedule, my life has been taken over with seating charts and mask mandates and, talking to parents about safety concerns or lack thereof in some cases.
A lot of administrative responsibility.
I'm finally starting to look at scores again.
That must be nice.
Yeah. But I've basically been an administrator all summer long.
Yeah. So what does that normally look like? Let's go back in time, pre-pandemic, as a conductor. Like, how does your administrative versus actual artistic responsibility balance out, at least in your current job?
Well, and that's something that I guess I should have expected, having already had some administrative experience, running a music festival. And conductors always have to recruit players, especially at Peabody. We have, for our recitals, we have to find players and buy them pizza and beer and sneak it through the security or whatever. But to convince the players to play in our orchestra, yeah. But, it's typically, in a typical summer, like going back to that specific example, I would be studying scores probably 2-3 hours a day, and I'd have maybe an hour allotted for emails and administrative stuff. It depends on what type of work you're doing, and also depends on the staff. So, when you're running a music festival and it's just your show, basically, you don't have any staff, like what I used to do in Iowa, then there's a lot of administrative things. But yeah, I find that sometimes I feel that 90% of my life is emails, and the last 10% is trying to throw together a score. So I'm trying to find that balance better. I have a routine that I try to stick to in the mornings now, where I can spend 5 minutes on clef reading exercises, 5 minutes on piano, 5 minutes on singing. I can get in and out, do some sort of like push-ups, musical push-ups, for at least 20 minutes at the beginning of every day. It's like conductor scales. And then from there, you know, you can, like, instead of starting your day looking at the email, just sort of put that off and get this thing done first.
Mm-hmm. So like doing that musical piece at the beginning so it doesn't get bounced around because of other things that come in. I want to go back to the email piece because you mentioned sometimes it feels like 90% of your day, which is a big percentage. So have you found any ways to mitigate email and like limit it in your day, or are there things that you're working on to help sort of balance that piece a little more?
Yeah, you know, I try to schedule times to make that happen. But specifically with emails and well, I'll call it phone calls or just general logistical communication, you know, administrative communication, which is related to music. It's all about putting the music together. But it's not specifically related to learning a score or to conducting a piece. You know, something I've learned actually through my interactions with my professor, Maren Alsop, is just, I'd write a long email and she'd write back a sentence. And I was like, okay, I get it. It's like, stick to one thing at a time. And that works well for, you know, now I'm also an executive director of a music festival and here in Sioux Falls. And so my day is split up with, you know, coming up with musical ideas and also, you know, grant writing and recruitment of board members. It's really helpful to just have one very short, you know, couple sentences in an email. And if it requires more than that, then you set up a phone call. I think you can actually accomplish the business that needs to be taken care of more quickly over the phone or over Zoom nowadays. So yeah, I mean, like a top tip to hack that is that I've discovered just through people that I've interacted with that are really good, not just Maren, but other people that I've, that are functioning at that really high level, is that they respond to emails pretty quickly, but with like a really short answer. And so I think that's more efficient. Just get to the crux of what you need to talk about and save the filigree for later.
So you mentioned this festival a couple times, and can you tell me more about how you got involved with the festival and like recruiting board members and those kinds of responsibilities? What goes into all of that?
Right. So there's two festivals that I have experience working with. The first one.
Oh, awesome. Okay.
Yeah. The first one is no longer really acting. I never officially canned it. It just sort of stopped. So that one is called the Iowa Great Lakes Music Festival in Okoboji, Iowa, which is nearby to Sioux Falls, about 2 hours drive away. I have family there. It's you never would have thought that there would be this beautiful vacation spot of lakes and lake fun in the cornfields of Iowa, but yet there it is. You can thank the glaciers in the last ice age for that little gem. So I grew up going there since I was a little kid, and you know, when I was still in school, I think I was, even before I came to Peabody, I was finishing my cello degree at McGill, and I, you know, with a conversation with a friend of mine, we thought, you know, Dvorak came to Iowa in 1893 or whatever. Wouldn't it be cool to have like a Dvorak festival? You know, we were trying to come up with a title. Thought, you know, well, there's mainly Mozart, mostly Mozart. What about definitely Dvorak? And luckily we decided not to go just with a geographic title. But yeah, it was a festival that ran. It was never a nonprofit, its own independent nonprofit. It always has it. It was a fiscally sponsored nonprofit. So the fiscal sponsor was actually the arts committee at a local Catholic church.
Can you back up and talk a little bit about how fiscal sponsorship works? Because I don't. In case some listeners,
I'm not familiar. A lawyer, so don't quote me. And you know, this is your disclaimer about legal advice. But yeah, basically, there's in the U.S. there are different types of nonprofits, and the point of being a nonprofit is essentially you don't have to pay taxes, and the people that give money to you, they can deduct that up to a certain level. They can deduct their gift to the nonprofit from their own taxes. So, but you still have to report everything, and there's a lot of scrutiny that comes with nonprofits because it's clear that there could be a lot of fraud. You know, it's a great way to get around paying taxes. So that means that you have to have things very clear and set up about what the mission of the organization is. But there are a few options. So if you, for example, if somebody wanted to start an orchestra, or if somebody wanted to start a music camp or a music festival. There are options. You know, if you want to be something called the 501c3, which is what all symphony orchestras are, for example, you have to have a board of directors. And depending on what state you incorporate in, there's certain rules about that. But basically, a board of directors, they are the custodians of the organization. Much like a board of directors in a corporate business, they're the ones that oversee the organization. But you can get around that, at least especially when you start. When you want to start a nonprofit, it's much easier to get going because you need to have a backlog or a track record to convince the IRS to let you incorporate as a nonprofit. So it's best to start with a fiscal sponsor. So maybe there's another foundation out there that is sole purpose is to fund or to house nonprofits under their umbrella.
Like Fractured Atlas is an example.
Right. So the way that this started, I had always intended to make it a nonprofit, and we actually never got to that point before I moved on to my work here in Sioux Falls. But the way I started this festival, beyond having the idea, was like, okay, I'm going to do a recital, a cello and piano recital. I'm going to be the cellist. I need to hire a pianist. And I'm looking for a venue to do this recital. So in the Iowa Great Lakes region, there's an art center there. And they have a performing arts, and it's quite a nice... They have a performing arts component to their programming, as well as the visual arts. And I went to them and I said, hey, I'd really like to put this concert on. You know, how can we make this work? There's probably some sort of fee for the use of the piano or whatever. And they basically convinced me not to do it. They were saying, well, we're more interested in, we're only interested in bringing in acts from Nashville, you know, having cover bands, et cetera, et cetera. But you should go down and talk to the church. The Father Tom is really interested in classical music and they have a really beautiful space. So that was kind of like for the first nail in the coffin, actually, that ended up kind of killing off the festival was, you know, that the local performing arts center passed up an opportunity for really high class music to be performed in their space. And that just sort of kind of gives you an example of sometimes people have different agendas. So then I went down and I met with the father, brought my cello, just walked in, kind of had a cold meeting set up and said, hey, I'd like to do a recital and, you know, can you help me raise some money? I'm going to need, I don't know, whatever it was, $500 for my pianist. And he said, and what about for you?
Great question.
Yeah. How much money do you need? And I'm like, oh, wow, I was going to do it for free. But now that you mention it, and so that's when I knew I had the right partner. In this venture, and he was able to make some calls, and through their arts committee, which is part, by the way, churches are also nonprofits, not 501c, it's C3, it's something else, I think. Yeah, so he was able to call a couple corporate sponsors, and bada bing, bada boom, we had the money we needed to do, and then also very handily, because we were under their umbrella of the arts committee, the volunteers of the arts committee of this church. They were able to help with publicity. So they were going around hanging up posters. They scheduled me with radio station interviews. And that was a huge jump start to this venture, which lasted about 4 or 5 years. And I think we started with a budget of $1,000. And I think we got up to about 7 to 10 over about 3 concerts worth of music by the biggest year.
So it sounded like having the right organizational partner was a huge help in getting it. So there's not all the responsibility was on you. Did you do anything differently? Did the conversation go differently with these different venues? If you were to approach a partner in the future, what would you kind of have in the back of your mind from like the not successful versus successful attempts?
You know, I think I had the same pitch for both ends. I think it was completely the interest of the person on the other side of the table. You know, this Catholic church, I'm not Catholic. I don't go to church. But a lot of my family does. So they knew Father Tom. A lot of people knew this person in the community and knew that he had this interest in music. You know, he studied and I think he was a choral director at one point and, you know, would visit Germany and Vienna all the time to go see concerts. So he was really passionate about the music. I mean, he was actually a page turner for some of our concerts for our pianists. Right?
That's awesome.
So he got it. That was really what's important. You need to find somebody who gets it. And at least one person.
So like the research behind that and like knowing like what is that person's goals so that you can connect with them when you meet with them.
And, you know, thinking back to the initial summer that I was doing this, you know, when I founded it, I was actually staying, you know, so I was on summer vacation, so to speak, from McGill. So I was living in Houston with my parents, spending the summer with them. And I would spend, besides practicing, you know, 3 or 4 hours a day on the cello, I would spend a good 2-3 hours on the phone calling family members, calling anybody that I knew in the Iowa Great Lakes community where I wanted to do this festival, asking them kind of topics all over the place, but basically saying, hey, I have this idea. I want to start this festival. What do you recommend? Who do you recommend I talk to? And then they would tell me a name, and then I would call them. And it was anything from finding a pianist, because I had to find somebody relatively local. I ended up finding somebody really wonderful in Minneapolis, which is, you know, drivable, 4-hour drive, which is in the Midwest is drivable. And so, yeah, it took a lot of, that's how, when you an entrepreneur, basically, right? When you were starting a thing, you want to start a music festival, you want to start an orchestra, you just need to talk to lots of people. And it's networking 101, essentially.
Sounds like you're figuring out what your community needs, what your community wants.
You have an idea of what you want to do, but you have to serve the community. So you have to find a way to meld your idea into what the community needs and what they want. And sometimes what they want and what they need is not exactly the same. You know, a lot of people would come up to me after our Iowa Great Lakes music concerts and say, thank you so much for bringing this music here. You know, there's a huge amount of summer performances. You can go, live music is all over the place. I mean, the Beach Boys, I saw the Beach Boys play at an outdoor venue in the Iowa Great Lakes when I was a kid.
That's great.
So it's a big venue, and there's a lot of people from all over, everyone vacations in the Iowa Great Lakes, from Iowa, Omaha, Sioux Falls, southern Minnesota. Everybody comes there. So it's a vacation destination. It seems ripe for a music festival. And especially because there was not any classical music in the community, I thought, oh, this is perfect. I got people who have means. I got people probably interested in this music. And so it was a matter of finding those people and you know, picking them out of the woodwork. And then they came to us at a certain point once we had this concert. And then over the years, they would keep coming back.
So all of this great experience that you got when you were putting this festival together, how has that informed your work with your newer festival, that your work at Sioux Falls, and then even with your orchestra that you work with?
So the big lesson, especially as a conductor, but also because conductors are kind of expected to be administrators in a way. But I think this is true for any musician now. We talk about entrepreneurship in music and what does that really mean? And, you know, the days of having a job that lasts your whole life, you know, I think in any level of the economy, you know, like back in the day, you used to work at the coal mine your whole life, or you used to work at the factory your whole life. That's not happening anymore. We all generally have like 3 or 4 different jobs anyways at the same time as musicians. And gig workers. You know, what I learned from this was, and I continue to learn, and it's been accelerated by coronavirus, is just how to work with people and diplomacy, politics, and politics not in the negative sense of the word. And I don't mean like Democrat, Republican. I mean in the political science practice of, hey, we need to do a thing. I'm going to start a thing. Let's make sure that people get what they want out of it. And it still fulfills our mission, and, you know, everything is ethical and whatnot. But
meeting everyone's needs.
Meeting everybody's needs and making sure everybody's happy. And learning how to negotiate. Negotiate not in like a pit, in a pounding your fist on the table, demanding what you want, but in finding a way that everybody can walk away happy and having respect for each other. And so that way you can, your reputation doesn't precede you in a negative sense. Oh, I've heard this guy. He's a real pain in the butt. but the opposite. Oh, he's really, you know, he's a straight shooter and I like working with him when we came up with something good. So that, I mean, yeah. And you have to ask for money. You have to know how to ask for money. Right. And that was that first meeting I had with the Padre was, hey, what's, I need some money for my pianist. And he said, and how about you? That was a kind of a great mentorship moment there. So moving forward now to what I do as in an orchestra. Now, you know, as an assistant conductor of the symphony and also the music director of the youth orchestra, which is under the umbrella of the symphony. There's a lot of staff members that you have to work with. And, you know, it's the same thing. It's all about working with people. And we can't, I don't think anybody has ever been able to in the past. Been able to just wall themselves off and just be a pure artist. I mean, even Beethoven had to struggle with publishers and try to find, donors for his and patrons for his work.
And ultimately, there's always an audience. So that's
people. And you have to find the audience. So it's that's the big thing. It's, you know, that's what's really difficult though, as being a musician. We have versus, I don't know, doing another job where the skills that we have to acquire have to start at such an early age and we have to put so much work to be an expert at our craft. And that's still not enough.
In terms of funding and asking for money, what have you sort of learned or what are your takeaways from now having had a few years in the books actually doing that?
Well, I'm by no means an expert in fundraising. The thing about fundraising, it's about it's not necessarily selling an idea. It's more a process of listening. There are people out there that have means, even if it's really small, even if it's like a $10 donation, right? But they have means and they want to make a difference. Part of what you do is you paint the picture. You first have to understand what their interests are, right? And if you're going to meet with a person, you know, there's probably some shared interest. And it's about painting the picture of what your vision is, but you wait to paint that picture until you hear what they have in mind. So you start with questions like, how do you feel about the current situation of the arts in our community? And what would, you know, you sort of lead them to seeing what your vision is. If that makes sense, it sounds manipulative, but it's just a,
No, I don't think it sounds manipulative. I mean, and I worked for a nonprofit as well. And so I identify with what you're saying. And I think that the key is really in like listening to what they are looking for. How do they want to make that impact? And then finding, again, those intersections between that and your organization. So if I'm a donor and I'm like, I'm really interested in kids and their musical experience. What programs do we have with youth that this person might identify with that they could be excited about, rather than going to them with like, oh, we have this really cool violin soloist that's coming. They're like, oh, I'm not really interested in that. Never mind. I'm not going to support
you. And somebody else might be interested in the violin soloist, or they might have been the reason why the violin soloist has been invited in the first place.
Right. And that person might be really excited to fund the soloist. So finding those intersections. So it sounds like you've been really creative with your work. With the youth orchestra, can you talk more about what inspires you to do that and what is most important to you with the programs that you're creating?
You know, I tried to be a composer when I was in like a freshman in college and it didn't go very well. It just wasn't my thing. But what I discovered through the process of trying to be a composer, it was that I love learning other people's music. I love learning how they came up with it, their system, their, you know, they're discovering their language, especially the 20th and 21st centuries where music is really, there's so many little isms. There's impressionism, there's expressionism, there's minimalism. And there's individual composers that are islands upon themselves. So I loved learning how music works. And I was inspired by the new ideas that somebody could come up with to make something really expressive and beautiful with a completely new language. And I wanted to share that with my students. I've at some of my downtime or darker times or more frustrating times of my, you know, fledgling career here, I get bogged down by all that logistical stuff we talked about, and it just felt like day-to-day stuff. And when I finally when I started to really embrace the logistical stuff was when I realized that that could be my creative, because I'm not a composer, that can be my creative thing, my creative activity, which is to create events, to create programs, and to bring creative other creative people together. So I think, and that is so wonderful for my own spirit. I feel that there's a major problem with our education system in that, and I mean like fundamental education systems, kids in school, from elementary, maybe even through college, is that it's, and I'm very much paraphrasing Sir Ken Robertson here, I'm reading one of his books, but basically we are training people to be workers. That was the whole point of education system. Before that, people just weren't educated, right? Before the Industrial Revolution, people didn't go to school. There was no such thing unless you were going to be a priest or unless you had a private tutor because you were very wealthy. You were not educated. And then it became important to have workers that were able to be literate, that could read instructions, that could read manuals, that could operate machinery. But you want those people to not be too independent, not to think too independently. Well, now the world has changed because we have robots doing those things. And we have artificial intelligence and we have computers doing those things. So people say this is the age of the creative class. And you talk to business leaders and corporations and, you know, people from all over the different sectors of the economy, and they say one of the most valuable skills is that we look for in a person that we're going to hire or the people that we have is we need them to be able to be adaptive because the world is constantly changing. You know, you're a toilet paper company in February 2020, and all of a sudden in March 2020, your business goes crazy. So you got to adapt, right?
Yeah.
So you need to have people who have skills, and I think they're teachable skills and learnable skills of being able to, they say, think outside the box, but be able to think creatively. So that's where I feel a creativity club can come in, because schools maybe still aren't really getting to that point of educating our kids and preparing them for these tasks of having to solve problems, think on their own and not just follow a manual, right? But to actually come up with invent a thing or come up with a better solution to something.
Do you have any other sort of final words of advice for students who are in school now?
Boy, I'm thinking almost like about advice that I would have for myself. You know, being in school, it's a difficult time. I found that my cello playing got so much, I judge it as being much better. I played more in tune. I was playing more expressively when I left school, because you realize when you're in school, basically as a musician, you've always been in school, right? Since the moment you started, you've had a private teacher. And the only audience that you typically have is your parents, and they're kind of biased, your teacher, and then the other students in your studio, and then maybe other families, right? And then you go on to conservatory, and it's even a huger microscope where you are constantly trying to judge yourself and figure out where you fit in on the hierarchy and pecking order of who's the best and whatever, and who's most successful. And what I realized when I had my first concert at the Iowa Great Lakes Music Festival was my audience, who I was really doing this for, didn't care. It wasn't about cello stuff anymore. It was just about they liked the music. And that was incredibly liberating. And it actually made my life more productive. I wasn't caught up in these sort of mental traps of just obsessing over intonation or whatever as a musician. And you get this feeling of being free, you know. And as a conductor, it's a tough thing to learn how to do, because you don't have an instrument to practice on except for very rare opportunities in class. And so Peabody gave you a lot of experience doing that. But you're getting your lesson, your private lesson, in front of 50 people in a room, and it's very personal. And it's very, you have to have a lot of chutzpah, you have to have a lot of grit to just say, you know what, I'm going to put my ego aside and I'm going to suck and everyone's going to think I suck, but you know what, it doesn't matter. It's the process of getting better. But once you get out into the world, your confidence, I think, goes way up. So I think for those of you guys that are still in school, it gets better. But there are things you miss about school. You're not surrounded by people who are passionate about the things that you're passionate about. And your life is not as structured as it used to be. But you know, I look back fondly in my time in college, and what I miss most is my interaction with my friends. But there's so many great things you can do. I mean, I think the future of, we'll call it classical music, is incredibly bright, because we're starting to really chip away at the old institutions and the way that they've always been. And we're really creating new things. The internet has given us those opportunities. And I think there's a whole class of people that have a hunger for this music and for new ways of presenting that music. So I think the future is very bright. We just got to survive the current virus and put food on our table and we'll get there.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Thomas. I really appreciate this. And it's been a pleasure speaking with you today.
Well, thanks for asking me. I really appreciate it, Christina.
You can hear more from Thomas on his new podcast called The State of Our Art, which explores music of the past, present, and future. Please see a link in our episode notes. To close out our episode, here is Thomas leading the Peabody Conductors Orchestra in an excerpt of Stravinsky's Firebird Suite. Theme music for the MaxQ podcast, created by Dmytro Nebish.